Welcome back to the show. I'm Tom, and today's episode is an interview with Sam Tierney, head brewer at Firestone Walker's Propagator, a cool little location just outside Los Angeles. The Propagator is essentially an R&D spot for Firestone Walker, but it's also got a restaurant, some really good food, some beers you're not going to find anywhere else. And as I discovered on a trip there, there's a merch and to-go store across the parking lot as well. Pro tip, there's a walk-in beer cooler in the corner with some really awesome stuff, vintage stuff, and my wallet was not happy when I discovered that, but it's almost impossible to leave without getting something you've never heard of. They've got a lot of interesting stuff there. So Sam, who we'll hear from, has been with Firestone Walker for about 10 years. We'll hear his story in a minute, but just wanted to remind you, if you didn't catch it last week, this show is now part of the Hopped Up Network, where you can find a bunch of other beer-centric podcasts from across the country. If you're interested in learning more, you can check that out, hoppedupnetwork.com. And yeah, I think that does it for the intro. So let's get to the conversation. My first question was basically, what got you going in beer? What got you into the business? What got you interested in the first place?
Well, I guess that goes back to college, and, you know, it's probably a pretty familiar story. I started homebrewing with my roommates, and, you know, we made horrible beer. It was just that awful, you know, kind of, I think it was a Cooper's extract kit that one of my housemates decided to get, you know, probably 19 at the time. And, but there was something there, something kind of clicked, and I was like, oh, you can make beer. That's cool. And then, you know, just started to get a little more interested in beer. And just kind of, you know, different beers that were out there. And, you know, I never really got into it as a teenager. Wasn't into beer at all. I think I drank some Coors Light in high school and didn't like it and kind of swore off beer for a while. But yeah, but kind of got back into it through, you know, trying some just really basic stuff, you know, like Sierra Nevada and Sam Adams and, you know, Widmer, the stuff that was available. I was going to college at UC Santa Barbara. So just stuff that was available there at the time. This would have been, you know, mid to late 2000s. And yeah, kind of got the homebrew bug and got really into it. Moved back. I was with my parents for a bit, you know, graduated college in 2009. And by the time that happened, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. And I had gotten really into homebrewing and kind of thought, you know, this would be something worth pursuing. And, you know, how could I go about this? So I had a little small kind of come by and help out kind of internship thing, doing basic grunt work at this brewery, Telegraph, in Santa Barbara. And, you know, I think sadly they've kind of gone by the wayside over the COVID. They were bought by Epic Brewing a few years ago, and I've kind of lost track with what's going on with them now. But, you know, it was enough to see how a small 10 barrel system worked, at least, you know, to hang out and brew day. And, you know, I would like label bottles and things like that. And I was like, this is really cool. I could do, you know, it just seemed like the coolest job in the world, especially for somebody who was 22 at the time. So yeah, I decided a good way to go about it would be to try to go to a brewing school. So, you know, I was looking at Davis, American Brewers Guild, Siebel, all that. So I ended up going to Siebel in 2010 in the fall. And did the kind of joint Chicago and Dumans Academy program in Munich. So I went there, did all that. And then was looking for, you know, a real job, real brewing job after that. And I had a few interviews, crashed on my buddy's couch in San Diego for a couple weeks, you know, trying to, you know, that was where I really felt like the scene was at the time. San Diego was really happening. And then, ended up getting this interview at Firestone after a couple months of looking around, and they offered me a job. And I think at the time I was 24 years old, and just like it, Firestone seemed like such big time, such like, wow, like this is so much bigger than I ever thought, you know, when I envisioned brewing beer. But I was like, you know, this could be a great experience. I should see what this is all about, you know, and just their focus on quality and, you know, how it was just something that, you know, fresh out of brewing school, I had kind of an eye for. I was like, wow, they're doing like everything I was learning in school. Basically, you know, they're actually doing this versus, you know, other small breweries I saw where I was like, well, this is a little more like home brewing kind of thing. And yeah. So it was a little intimidating, but I decided that, you know, it seemed like a great place to start. You know, I had no idea that I'd still be around 10 years later.
Yeah. So, Propagator opened in 2016, I think. I could be wrong about that, but
yeah, that's correct.
Okay, so you were already with Firestone at that point. Did you move to the Propagator when that came online?
No, I actually moved to the Propagator in 2019.
Okay.
So it's been a little more than 2 years now. Yeah, I stuck around, you know, kind of did all the brewing positions in Paso at the main brewery, moving around, just, you know, starting as a shift brewer, cleaning bright tanks, night shift, you know, getting a little time on the brew house, but mostly focusing on cellar and doing the union barrels, bourbon barrels. You know, kind of like, you know, the way we handle the brewing staff up there is we try to really get everyone to rotate around to everything. So, you know, it's basically three main stations are, you know, filtration, cellar, brew house, and then barrel special project stuff. And so I got to get around and do all that. And then after 3 years of kind of rotating through all the shifts, I went to this other role called QC Brewer, which we have one brewer that does. And the primary responsibility for that position is our yeast management. And so, you know, a brewery that size, it's really important to be, you know, really on top of the yeast and make sure you have yeast all the time. You have the correct strains for the beers on the schedule, that, you know, the lab's propagating new pitches when they need to be, when, you know, when you hit a certain amount of generation, stuff like that. So we have somebody that focuses on that. And then, you know, then you kind of become like a shift lead too. So in the time that you don't spend on that, you're helping train new people, you're working on special projects, you know, implementing new techniques in the brewery, things like that. So I had a few years doing that and then moved up to the cellar manager position. So I was overseeing all the cellar stuff. We commissioned a new centrifusion filter right when I started in that position. So that was a really big project for me. A lot of learning. I mean, definitely that was a lot of fun, getting to do that. And then, you know, after a couple years of doing that, came down to LA to do the Propagator. So, the Propagator had been open since 2016, and there were a couple brewers that had been in charge of it before. So I was the third brewer to take it over, and yeah, so I've been there for a little over 2 years.
Okay. Propagator is, am I right? And it's a 10 barrel system there.
Yeah, 10. It's actually, so it's okay. A German Kasper Schultz brew house, a three vessel, mash kettle combo, a louder ton and a whirlpool. And, it's, yeah, nominally 10 hectoliters, but we can, you know, add some water back into the whirlpool to get a little more volume, which okay. is really handy for brewing like hazy IPAs and stuff when you want to cool it down. Okay. So it's actually a pretty good brew house for doing that kind of stuff.
How much, how much are you guys, or you, or, you know, whatever team is there, how often are you guys brewing there? And do you get to do any core stuff there on a smaller scale, or do you not get to mess with that stuff?
No, you know, that's one of those things that I've always thought that would be kind of fun to try and brew some of those beers, but just, it's a pretty small cellar. We only have four fermenters. So we have four 20 barrel tanks. So we double batch into most of them most of the time, unless we're doing something really out there and new that we just don't really know what's going to happen. And we'll just do a single turn, but you know, we're usually doing two turns a week. So we're doing two brews, 2 days, and filling up one of those tanks. And yeah, it just doesn't really fit in the schedule, I guess, to say, okay, let's knock out some 805 or something. But we do bring some of the retired beers back. So that's part of it. You know, we just released a new batch of Wookie Jack last week, and that we're going to be doing for GABF again. Since we won a medal with it last year, that was, you know, it's always got to do that again. And whenever we bring that back, we brought it back into cans earlier this year too, just doing a couple small 200 case runs out of the Propagator with mobile canning. And that just gets people really excited that are fans of those beers. So it's nice to do. So, you know, some of the other ones, we used to bring back some old school stuff. Our brown ale that we did for years and years, that used to be part of the Nectar line back in the day, when we had that brand as well. And then we had an IPA, a Nectar IPA that kind of got rebranded into another beer. So stuff that, you know, longtime fans could come by and drink, especially people that have been coming to our tap rooms, you know, for over 10 years, 10, 15 years, you know, they like those beers. But as trends have changed, I think, you know, we're really selective about what we do. So, so yeah, no core stuff really.
Okay. I haven't, until you just said that, I haven't heard the Nectar name in quite a while. I think the last thing I had was like a 2012 Black Xantus. That was quite a while ago.
Oh yeah. No, that was such a great beer actually.
Yeah.
So it kind of evolved as we brewed it. You know, and it's obviously, I don't even know the status of that stuff these days, but that was a really good one to do. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I was hoping you would say there was like a propagator Pivo limited batch or something coming. I think that would be fun, but also it's a different system and all that. So, and you
Yeah.
guys are 25 years old this year, I think,
Yeah,
Firestone.
25 years.
So there's probably a certain amount of don't mess with what we've got up in Paso.
Yeah, absolutely.
Being in, I guess technically Marina del Rey, just on one side of the street versus Venice, right? Or do I have that backwards?
Yeah, essentially the border is kind of the street that we're on.
Yeah.
It's funny, I've heard some people tell me, well, I think technically this is actually Venice. If you go by the old maps, people that have been old timers been around, but it's right on the line essentially, and the address, our actual mailing address is Marina del Rey.
Right. But being in general in the LA beer scene, do you know, was the location choice of for the propagator, did that have to do with LA, that whole scene really starting to take off, maybe whatever it was like 10 years ago or so? Or was it just kind of far enough from home and the big Southern California market, a little easier to get to than from the Central Coast?
Yeah, I think that kind of all that wrapped up essentially. LA's always been a really big market for Firestone since they really started distributing out of the Central Coast, which was pretty early on. And there's just obviously the LA market is very developed now, and there's so many good breweries down here, and there's such a good beer scene. But yeah, 10 years ago that wasn't really the case. There were, a few good breweries getting going and things were starting up. But things have really boomed since then. And I think around the time, that they were planning this location, things were really starting to get going and there was more energy. And where we are on the Central Coast is an amazing place. Having lived there for 8 years, I absolutely loved it. LA has a lot of advantages too, obviously. But the thing about the Central Coast is there is a little bit of isolation there, and there are more breweries now, but especially when I started 10 years ago, it's like, there weren't very many other breweries around. There were just a handful in our area, and you always felt like you were a little bit out on your own. That's why the Invitational was always so great, because you get, a lot of the world's best brewers all coming to town and hanging out for a weekend, and that's really awesome. So I love doing that kind of stuff. But the choice of LA was really saying, hey, here's the core market for us, and we want to strengthen our relationship with it, and and get some of that energy, some of the creative energy of what's going on. And it's not just beer too, it's the culture, it's everything, the art of Southern California. And I think, we were really inspired by all the great art that's come out of Venice, the skateboarding scene, surf scene, stuff like that, and just really wanting to connect more of that. And I think, with Firestone, the kind of direction the brewery's really wanted to go is kind of double down on being this Californian brewery and saying, hey, we're from California, and we really want to embrace our Californian-ness. And even though the brewery, part of the ownership is with Duvel, I think part of that is saying we're still committed to our local customers and the scene and in California. And I think all the investment that we've done in the area has been just to kind of show that to everybody, that we're really committed to it. So doing the LA thing was, I think, a big part of that too.
Yeah, and I was thinking at the time, it was probably easier to get into LA than necessarily San Diego, where it's obviously a very much more established beer scene, and it was, 5, 10 years ago, much more established. It just seems like a good fit to be there and like kind of, I don't know how to describe that. It seems like a better fit to me than like if Firestone opened a small brewery or a tap room in San Diego. I think it would feel kind of forced.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think, LA just, it was kind of this area that, yeah, we already sold a ton of beer in and had a good relationship with distributors and drinkers here, and just said, hey, we want to just kind of move in and have an official foothold here and be part of the neighborhood. And so, we have more staff down here now, some of our marketing department's down here, and it's really great, doing collaborations with artists and stuff like that. There's really a lot more opportunities here than you would just get in Paso alone. So it's nice to have it. Absolutely.
Right. Well, I saw that recently, I think not this most recent issue, but maybe the one before for Craft Beer and Brewing, you had written up a a piece on kind of myth busting lagers and things that people think about it that aren't necessarily true, and breaking down techniques and stuff like that. Is lager your, or in general, your favorite kind of style to brew, or what is that if not?
Ooh. I do love lagers. Absolutely. I think it all kind of goes back to, just my history getting into beer, you know, going over to Germany in brewing school, and just really, I don't know. I just remember hanging on to every word of the instructors over at Dumas, and, you know, and just being like, this is where it's at. This is where like the kind of like the torch of beer knowledge is carried on, you know, kind of thing. And also, you know, I guess I didn't mention before, but I did go to Oktoberfest when I was in college, and that was a huge eye-opening experience for me too, I think, when I was just starting to get into beer and really seeing the German beer culture and seeing, you know, everything that kind of went into it. And that actually also pushed me into the direction of wanting to be a brewer at the time. So yeah, I've always had a big respect for lagers. And I think that, you know, part of that piece was just, you know, it wasn't to really throw down and say, hey, anybody's wrong for doing what they do, or for, you know, being more traditional, or to doing more old techniques. You know, I have the utmost respect for breweries that, you know, do a lot of those traditional techniques. And I think I don't disagree with a lot of the kind of the thinking of saying, hey, you know, it's like, I've heard it explained a few times that, you know, there's all of these little things that add up. It's, you know, it's 100 little details, and does one matter? Maybe not. But as you start peeling them back one by one, you end up with a different product kind of thing. And I think there's definitely something to that. And, but I think there's an alternative view that says, you know, with modern technology and equipment, we can definitely look at some of those techniques and say, hey, you know, we can do things in a more modern way and still uphold quality and make the beer we want to make. So yeah, so I kind of like, I absolutely love lagers, and I love the traditional lagers and traditional techniques, but I also, you know, like looking at it from a little bit of a scientific view and just saying, hey, you know, here's some other ways to look at it, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know coming into this that you'd gone to, that you had done the Siebel program and been over there in Germany. So that's, you probably have a pretty good perspective on both sides of it, especially now being pretty much any ingredient is fair game, and just how different things can be. I could go down the rabbit hole of, you know, what's beer and what's not beer, and I have my opinions, but yeah, having the perspective on it is probably pretty helpful when doing something like that piece, because it was much more in depth than I had thought it was going to be.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think I really got into the ideas of, you know, if you add fruit to a lager, is that okay? You know, just because they would do it in Germany or something like that, you know, it's like, I don't even want to touch that. You know, that to me, that's like kind of out of the scope of what we were trying to get across. It was more just like, hey, you know, what's really going on during lagering on a chemical level, and, you know, what are you getting out of it, and, you know, how can you approach it differently, perhaps? And it just, you know, that was the experience that we had, you know, brewing beers like Pivo and Lager and Oktoberfest, you know, stuff that we've done for years now at Firestone. And beers, you know, some of those beers evolved. You know, I got to see a couple different approaches to Pivo in the cellar and fermentation, you know, since we started brewing that beer. And, you know, and we're always kind of subtly tweaking it, but it's never changed that much, you know. It's always stayed a very consistent beer for the most part, but, you know, we tried, you know, doing separate lagering tanks, doing single tank systems, you know, centrifuging, not centrifuging, stuff like that. You know, try to cut a few different ways to approach, you know, how we handled fermentation, lagering times, things like that. And, you know, just kind of learned, you know, where we thought the lines were as far as, you know, what's happening to the beer and how, you know, and how as a brewer, you can kind of use some of the tools of, you know, especially if you're able to analyze sulfur in the lab and things like that, you can look at it and say, hey, you know, here's the lines where we're hitting the flavor we want, you know, having a well-trained sensory panel with, you know, multiple validated panelists that you can, you know, do triangle testing, you can do different kinds of blind tests to say, okay, you know, when is it really the flavor that we want, and when do we agree, on that? Because I think you can kind of get caught up, and especially in a small brewery with a couple brewers, or just, one head brewer that kind of drives those decisions from a sensory standpoint. You can kind of get caught up in the mental game of like, well, if I don't let it sit this many weeks, it doesn't taste right. I taste it 2 weeks later, and it's like, well, how much of that's your palate? How much of that's in your head? And are there other ways around that? So I just, I wanted to kind of put those questions into people's heads and say, are we getting a little too romantic about some of these things because that's the way they've always been done? Or are they really making a difference that we can taste that really matter? But I also respect people for whatever decision they make, because sometimes it's really just about the tradition and wanting to do it that way. And that's so much of what makes beer so interesting, I think, and engaging on a cultural level, is the tradition and the history. So I think it actually does matter, that kind of stuff, So I think even if in a blind test, you couldn't tell the difference of one little thing you did, if you're saying, hey, I'm doing it this way because this is how generations of brewers have done it, and, don't fix it if it ain't broken kind of thing, I think that's equally valid.
Yeah, that just made me think of decoction and the arguments on both sides of that. I've heard very impassioned arguments on both sides about, it does make a big difference this way, or that it's just for some color. And after, the last interview that I did, he was talking about with how modified grains are, that, a lot of this, like you were saying, a lot of the kind of traditional, well, that's the way it's always been done, isn't always necessary anymore because of technology and ingredient quality and modification. So yeah, I think putting those questions in people's heads are going to be hopefully provoke good dialogue and not just more arguing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't, as far as decoction goes, I don't really have a dog in the fight. It's not something that we do. It's actually something I'm going to be trying very soon here. I think I've been thinking about it a lot and kind of going through all those arguments, like you said, and listening to a lot of interviews recently, actually pretty much every interview I could find with anybody that does it, I've been listening to see what their take is on it. And it's interesting because when I was at Doman's, they kind of acknowledge decoction and talk about it, but they always come down. I think, modern German brewers that are coming out of, Weihenstephan or Doman's or VLB, there a lot of modern German brewing has moved to being more efficient. It's all about saving energy. Energy is really expensive in Germany. And, and there's a lot of, and whether the brewers have rationalized it for cost-cutting measures as well, or time-saving measures, and kind of tried to wrap that up in the green movement and say, hey, if we're saving this much, fuel cost on this, it's making our beer better for the environment or whatever, that's definitely an argument I heard multiple times for why they would move to infusion versus decoction. There will be the smaller, generally more traditional brewers that'll say, you are losing something there. And I don't know. So I kind of came away from that with the brewers there saying that they don't think it's necessary, but there may be, there still is going to be some flavor thing that you're going to lose. There's enough great brewers that believe that I'm not, I them, I mean, there's brewers that I respect the hell out of that, will tell everyone that, no, it matters, for our beer. And I've heard that enough times that, I, there's no way they're wrong. So we'll see. I don't know. You might see, we might try a decoction on Pivo and see how it goes, with always kind of following a traditional German step infusion, but without doing the decoction.
Well, and one thing that you guys do that, I can't remember which brewery, I think there's only one like commercial size brewery in England that still does it, is the Burton Union, the system. And it's, you guys have it a little bit modified for, modern times, right? It's not just, I mean, it's not like 1850 in there.
No. Yeah. No, the Firestone Union is kind of its own distinct system. Whereas the Burton Union, a big aspect of it, there's kind of the two core things about it. So the first is neutral oak. So it's not trying to impart oak flavor in the beer. And I don't know if they're pitch lining or just trying to make the barrels neutral when they put new ones in. I can't recall what the exact system that Marston's is still employing is, but, the Firestone system was bringing in new oak barrels. Well, it was originally Chardonnay barrels from the Firestone Winery, because when the brewery started, it was started in a back kind of space of the Firestone Winery in Santa Ynez. The Chardonnay barrels were a holdover from that. But, you know, they had some issues with that in the beginning. It's hard to take used wine barrels and make clean beer. As you know, most people figured out over the years, it's really good for sour beer, but not so good for clean beer. It can be done. You know, I think with people, you know, with modern cleaning equipment and sulfur and all that, it can be done. But, so we switched to, brand new American oak barrels, and that gets, you know, some flavor. So you're getting some coconuts and woody notes from that and all that kind of stuff. You know, vanilla, good stuff that winemakers are looking to get. Basically we're getting, we're buying new wine barrels essentially that just haven't seen wine yet. And then the other one is we're not using it as a yeast collection system. So the Burton system traditionally, you know, had this small X come out, and you can actually see the original Firestone Union setup is on the wall in Paso Robles in the tap room. So if you, I don't know if you've been there, but in that one they have that.
I have. It's been
and
a while.
So that actually. Yeah, there's the pipes coming out of the top of each one, and they all join into a center manifold. And then, you know, you're collecting yeast into a bucket that comes out of that. Mm-hmm. And just because of the yeast strains they were using at the time, that was a really efficient way to harvest yeast, kind of a way to almost like automate the top cropping versus, you know, scooping it with a shovel and a bucket. But, you know, we decided not to do that also for just, you know, with the yeast strain we were using and just issues, you know, with sanitation, harvesting yeast like that. It becomes a very complex system that's hard to manage. And we didn't need the yeast out of it. So, you know, we weren't moving over our entire production to it. Even though they did, I mean, it was a huge part of the production early on, but as we grew, it kind of became this niche thing that, you know, was only a portion of the DBA we were brewing, and we weren't doing it for other beers. So you're getting, you know, it's basically just a barrel fermentation system, you know, where we're putting the, you know, DBA or English pale ale is going in at about 24 hours. So as soon as we're seeing a good cell count of the beer, you know, and fermentation's kicked off. So we're going to get a consistent fermentation in every barrel. Then the beer, while it's actively fermenting, gets filled into the barrels and then finishes out. And then we wait until it, you know, clears its diastole rest and then transfer the beer out. It's usually about a full week in the barrels. It kind of finishes out and then has a little maturation time for a few days in there, and then goes back into a tank where they all get blended back together, and then we can use that for blending.
Okay. Yeah, I knew it wasn't quite the same, but obviously Firestone Walker's been doing that for quite a while, so you guys obviously have that figured out. And yeah, I think if nothing else, I think people are still kind of enchanted by that older way, and it's not just going in stainless and then cranking it out and still calling it that. Like, it makes me think of you know, the Budweiser, the Beechwood aged on the can, and it's like, by all accounts I've heard, the still using the Beechwood chips or spirals or whatever is basically so they don't have to change the advertising on the can. And I think that maybe is just easier than changing the label and doing all that. But that's kind of more of a marketing thing than actual end result.
Yeah.
Well, earlier today, I had a bottle of Firestone Lager that's gone into bottles. And then was it DBA that's also gone, or that's stayed in bottles, but new design. Is that on DBA?
Yeah. For the 25th anniversary, we decided to do a kind of heritage pack that's got lager or, that's Pivo and DBA and Union Jack. So lager was separate, but lager did get the refresh with a new label, but it's not in that mixed pack. But all those beers also got the 25th anniversary refresh. So it's the same kind of look. It's our, you know, throwback to some of the original label designs. But lager, rebranding for the anniversary was a big one, for us. They wanted to do that and kind of give it a more traditional look. You know, lager was one of the original beers that we did back in the day when we only did a few beers. And then, lager actually was cut for Union Jack. And so that, you know, that, I think that signals a big shift. And I think that was the end of 2006. Was when Union Jack came out, and, you know, 2006, that was, you know, the cutting edge of West Coast IPA at the time. And that signaled a big shift for the brewery of saying, okay, we're going to be an IPA brewery now. We had been brewing Nectar IPA. And like I said, with the Nectar beers at the time was another brand that Firestone did. And so there was Nectar IPA, but there was no Firestone IPA out there. So Union Jack was the first one. And, before that it was pale ale and DBA and lager. And then Walker's Reserve Porter, those were the core beers. So it's, very traditional lineup actually. And then lager, was at the time it was time to retire it and say, okay, we're going to do an IPA now. But it was great to bring it back, a few years ago when we brought it back and, slight refresh on the recipe, but essentially the same beer, not very different. You always want, I think, when you bring something back like that, years and years later, you learn a few tricks,
Yeah.
there's no way around that. But yeah, it's good to see that we've kind of been able to keep that one going as such an original beer for us.
Yeah. That the Firestone Lager, that's is that the same or essentially the same now as it was when you said just a few years ago it came back and it was in six pack cans and
Yes.
probably other things, but I would see six pack cans and yeah, I'm a big fan of that beer. So I'm glad that I was afraid that it was going to be something different and that was going to get the axe
Oh
with
yeah,
the
I know it.
bottles.
Yeah, I know it was hard to find for a bit, and we had to actually cut the cans. Well, it was out of package for a little bit, and that was just because when COVID hit and we had to kind of shift our packaging, we had to. Some of the low hanging fruit as far as like, what could be taken off the schedule because we just weren't getting the volume of orders to sustain it. And then, we focus on what was working for us at the time. If I mean, if you think, we had a lot of keg beer that we had to, take back out of the market and eat up. And so, we were shifting to package beer as hard as possible to make up the volume and keep the brewery running. And so there were a few things like that. Yeah. That had to happen, unfortunately. But yeah, bringing it back, same beer hasn't changed. Just,
Okay.
we're able to say, hey, this is a good time to do a rebrand and put it back out.
Okay. And did the did going into bottles with and the refresh on some of those, did the bottles have to do with the can shortage or the predicted can shortage, or was that just like just part of the refresh that like the lager going in cans and I know Union Jack's been in cans, but I started seeing that in can or that Union Jack has been in bottles. Started seeing it in cans, and mostly I feel like I see it in bottles.
Yeah, a little bit. I think we definitely had to work with our can supplier on that and just figure out how to weather that for sure. And I think, we're lucky that this at our size and at the orders that we do, we have a lot more like they work with us to maintain some stability, so it wasn't completely that. Just as much was our capacity for our canning line. A big thing was we actually put a second bottle line online a little bit before then. And so, this is a couple years ago, but we added a second line because 805 has always been really popular in bottles. And so, our canning line is a little faster than our original bottling line. And so we kind of had both of those cranking. And then, to focus on 805, we got a second bottling line. And the second bottling line is basically the same capacity as the first. And so they're both relatively high capacity, but for us, we were able to put out more bottles. So then, we decided with some of those beers, the cans were, we were basically maxing out what we could do with our canning line. And then we were saying, okay, what can we bring back in bottles that is going to be good for bottles because we do have a little more capacity on the bottling line.
Okay. Yeah, it's I don't know if the can shortage is still looming on the horizon, but I wondered if that had anything to do with it. But yeah, I at a place as big as Firestone Walker, yeah, it's you guys make a lot of beer. So there's also just keeping up with demand.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unless I remember to write it down, I always forget to ask this one. Do you have a favorite hop or at least a favorite hop at the moment?
Ooh, that is a really tough one. I think especially with working the propagator now and kind of, looking at new combinations all the time and new hops and it's always kind of like, what's the latest thing that I've fallen in love with? Because, we'll take a lot of single hop beers through the schedule and, you know, get to know new hops. And we've actually shifted a lot of that up. We got so overwhelmed with single hop brews that that we bought a bunch of one barrel fermenters that we actually just divert wort to in Paso. And so we can easily do single hop beers up there because, you know, I was doing full batches of single hop beer here. And a lot of those, you know, have turned into those mixed pack propagator beers that you can get in stores. But you know, it was taking up a lot of our capacity here. So we said, hey, we can knock these out one barrel at a time and just do them internally. So I actually have kind of stepped back from some of the single hop stuff. But, you know, some of the, I'd say the most recent one, if I had to just, you know, I had to just go for it, probably Rewaka. You know, this was the first year that we really got to utilize a lot of hops from New Zealand. You know, we've been working on contracts for a few years. Some stuff was trickling in the last couple of years, but you know, we were working with some suppliers to, you know, get the volumes that we needed to actually put some of that stuff out. You know, the New Zealand markets, you know, the New Zealand, you know, hop growing areas still relatively small compared to the U.S. It's actually quite small. And so it's been really hard to get some of these varieties. But with a couple of new farms getting going and some new processing coming online, we were able to get plenty this year. And so we were able to put them in some Luponics and some of the, you know, single hop beers in our mixed packs. So I definitely Rewaka. I think, you know, there's something about the kind of like tropical, it's like, it's almost like berry and wine and diesel all at the same time. I don't know. It's, I loved it. And, you know, we immediately put it into, I think, two of our can releases of the propagator this spring. Three in a row. That's how much we were loving it. It was that Nelson. We got some really good Nelson too. And so I was just like, okay, this is going to go into everything until I'm sick of it. Every new IPA we develop, you know, so yeah, a really awesome hop. And it was one of those ones where, you know, it took us way too long to be able to get enough to use, but yeah, we're very happy that we have it now.
Well, being at the propagator and doing a lot of the kind of one-off or experimental, or, you know, you have an idea, you can, I would guess that you have pretty much free range to experiment as you want on a system like that. And when that's, I think, a big point of having a system like that. And when I was there, there was a Westphalian, however you want to, I don't know the German on that, but IPA that was, I think it said it was fermented with a Kolsch yeast, and a Kveik Imperial Stout, and some different like multi-brewery blends. And with all those things, what is the weirdest or like most out of the box thing that you've done at the propagator?
I think, you know, a lot of people listening would probably say that nothing we do is that out of the box. You know, if you listen to what other brewers are doing that are really pushing the definitions of beer and, you know, what you were going to put in beer, I think that, you know, we're relatively traditional really when it comes down to it. I'm trying to think of like what, you know, most out there we got. I think some of the stuff, you know, I don't know, some of the kind of like fruit things that we were doing, you know, as far as like fermenting and then blending different beer. Like we did a mango IPA, you know, we're blending mango into fermentation, mango puree, and then, you know, coming up with a hop blend to complement that and all that. And so, you know, we definitely work on projects like that. But yeah, I'd say we're just not really that kind of brewery for the most part. You know, I think, you know, a project that we did a lot of work on, you know, a lot of these are like kind of long-term development projects for new product lines. So we had this rosé beer, Rosalie, which some people will probably remember, but has unfortunately gone away. But that was really the start of us doing wine hybrid fermentations here. And I think that's probably, you know, I mean, it's something that we've been doing for a while, actually, at Firestone, especially on the sour side with Barrel Works. And then we'd actually done a few clean beers with it already up in Paso, even before the propagator. We did a collaboration with Castoro Cellars for a couple of years, doing a pale ale with Sauvignon Blanc must blended into fermentation. But we started doing that with a bunch of different stuff at the propagator. So we were doing kettle sours, you know, with Chardonnay must blended into fermentation, or a mix of different white grapes that we were picking from the local area. So we would get that juice pressed up in Paso and then send it down and brew with it at harvest time. And so, yeah, so we developed Rosalie kind of doing that system and kind of figuring out how would you do, you know, a tart kind of, you know, Berliner Weiss style beer, but then make that a wine hybrid. And then, you know, we eventually had a hibiscus and made this kind of rosé beer. So that was a really involved project that was actually done here before I came down here, but I worked on it on the other side up there in cellar in Paso. And, you know, that was the first time we were actually bringing, you know, a lacto fermentation into the cellar. So that was a big deal up there. You know, obviously it's kind of to be the cellar manager at the time thinking, okay, I'm going to have a tank that's just, you know, 200 barrels of lactobacillus beer fermenting right next to, you know, an IPA and a pale ale and whatever. But luckily, you know, it never caught us. So then we kind of pivoted from that. And so, you know, we did a few IPAs and last year we did a couple double IPAs, wine hybrid IPAs that I was really proud of that. You know, unfortunately, you know, for better or worse, just didn't end up being something that we scaled up into a bigger project. But, you know, we were just seeing what else you could do using, you know, local wine must. You know, being in a wine region up there, you know, you've always have winemakers, you know, that we're hanging out with, and, you know, everybody drinks wine for the most part. All the brewers are into it and love the process and just love wine. So, you know, that's been something we've had a great relationship for a long time, obviously. And so doing the wine hybrids is really fun. So we did a hazy and a West Coast wine hybrid double IPA. And I just love the way double IPAs with grapes, work out. So hopefully we'll be doing more of that in the future.
Okay. Yeah. I thought I don't think I've ever heard of a stout or Imperial stout being done with the Kvike yeast before. But it just seems kind of, I don't know. It seems like it kind of fits for the propagator and different ideas that you can play with.
Yeah, absolutely. We started doing them, you know, after, I don't know, this would have been right when I came down there. Actually, we did the first one. We just did an IPA, you know, everybody was like, oh, you can make a hazy IPA with it. It's interesting esters. So we kind of did kind of like a West Coast haze with it. But then I saw a talk that Omega East gave at the California Craft Beer Summit in 2019 in Long Beach. And I think it was Lance from Omega. And just the way he was kind of talking about the history of the yeast and all that got me inspired. So we actually did a Norwegian farmhouse ale where we infused the mash water with juniper. So that's probably a pretty uncommon technique, actually, now that I think about it. It's the only time we've done that. But, you know, you would do a hot water infusion with your hot mash water, steep the juniper branches, and really, you really get this unique kind of flavor of kind of like evergreen juniper, really kind of woody. And then that, you know, you get just a subtle hint of that in the beer. And then, you know, maybe make a, the beer was, you know, some of the build was kind of like a Doppelbock almost, but it was kind of mimicking what they do in the Voss area of Norway. You know, they would do, you know, direct fire, you know, 5-hour boil or something like that and really caramelize it to a greater extent. We have a steam fired German brew house, so we can't do that. There is no caramelization that ever happens. As long as you brew, you just, you know, evaporate a little more. So we had to add some specialty malts and things like that, but that was a really fun beer. And I, you know, I think a lot of people got a kick out of, you know, having a beer that had the juniper infusion in it. So, you know, hopefully we'll do something like that again.
Yeah. Well, and even that has the very traditional aspect of, like you said, of that region and, that I think people are learning more about and hearing more about. And there's that book that came out last year, maybe, or 2 years ago, I can't remember what it's called. I think historical brewing techniques or something like that.
Yeah.
And then there was more specific one. Yeah. Then there was another one that was a little more specific to the Norwegian farmhouse beers. But yeah, the traditional aspects are really fun to see people playing with, and especially with, you know, modern technology and science and being able to take it to different places. My next question, I don't know how far down we've got on this already, but talking about the extremes of where beer has been going for a few years now. And, you know, when hazy IPA was like kind of extreme. And then there's, you know, obviously we talked about all the different adjuncts that can go in that are not historically brewing ingredients. Where I don't know. Do you have an idea or a guess about what is the next thing that, you know, next, I don't know. I wouldn't say ingredient, because there's like, I'm sure anything that hasn't been thrown in beer already will be by the end of the year. But, you know, where do you see beer going with the kind of the extremes or the trends that people maybe don't think of as traditional, or don't think of as maybe appropriate or anything like that for beer?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that seltzer is a fundamental shift in that arena. And the reason, I say that is because we've basically divorced the traditional beer flavor profile from a beverage that people think of as essentially beer. So, you know, brewers are making seltzer now as something that is beer adjacent. You know, it's a fermented sugar. And then it can be flavored however you want. So instead of saying, okay, I have to deal with malt flavor, and then I'm going to flavor it with all these other things that I really want to taste like, you know, I want to make, you know, the beer that tastes like some sort of, you know, confection or pastry or fruit or a cocktail or anything like that. You don't have to compromise anymore. You can just say, I have a completely neutral base that's just alcohol and water, essentially, with, you know, just a slight hint of fermentation byproduct flavor, but, you know, we're going to carbon filter it and take that, as much of that out as possible. And then, you know, now I have a blank canvas and I can do whatever I want. So some of the stuff I'm seeing, you know, like, you know, cocktail kind of seltzers, where you can do, essentially you're making canned cocktails with a seltzer base. You know, and also the other thing with seltzer and using like the turbo yeast, distiller's yeast with them, is that you can get high alcohol fairly easily. So it's very easy to make a 15% alcohol seltzer base, and then you can blend all sorts of fruit and things into it and still arrive, you know, at a normal kind of beer strength beverage that, that has, you know, it's almost whatever flavor you want. So to me, that's like, that's the new frontier, is saying it's like, maybe beer was holding brewers back, if that makes any sense. You know, in the pursuit of making new novel flavors, they realize that we don't even really want it to taste like beer, so who cares? So let's just make an alcohol, fermented alcoholic beverage that tastes like what we want to taste like. And that's what seltzer's given us, this kind of revolution in the industry that, you know, obviously some brewers have latched onto more than others. I mean, I just saw the statistic reported yesterday that, I think Boston Beer is now, it's like 8 or 9% of their portfolio is Sam Adams now, you know, and the rest is non-beer beverage. And you know, the vast majority of that is Truly. And so, you know, they've pivoted so effectively, and I mean, they're doing so well as a business because of it. And they're really killing it when it comes to that arena. I mean, you should see, you know, there are a lot of Truly fans at Firestone, especially the Truly lemonades. So yeah, it's just,
are those the like the certain, frozen lemonade ones?
I think they just do, you know, different lemonade flavors. They're just the sweeter ones.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. Maybe that might be a new one that I'm not familiar with yet. I'm not that into them. You know, I try a few as they pop up just to kind of see what's going on. And you know, I gotta hand it to them. Like, some of them I find pretty tasty. It's just not, I don't really have necessarily a passion for it. But you know, you've got to see what's out there. That's something that, you know, we're not doing currently, but I think, you know, we're gonna be getting possibly into on some level in some way at some point. You know, it's just probably undeniable, but it's not something I have not yet brewed a seltzer at the Propagator, so we'll see how that goes.
Okay.
But yeah, I guess, you know, to me that's, yeah, the new frontier with flavor and new stuff, because otherwise, you know, there's only so much you can do with beer. I almost feel like the new things that are really interesting for me is where hops are going. You know, we've always been really into new hop varieties and, you know, and the work that Matt Bernelson, our brewmaster, has done with the Hop Growers of America over the years, you know, spreading, you know, the knowledge of American hop varieties around the world is really, you know, phenomenal. And he was just awarded the Order of the Hop, which is an award, an industry award given out every year to someone for exemplary service to the industry. And I'm not sure, but I think maybe only a couple other brewers have ever won that. It's mostly other hop industry people. And so, you know, since he's been working for years, you know, they were, you know, as a thank you, they're like, hey, you know, we're going to honor you with this award. And we're actually brewing a collaboration with Yakima Chief Hops coming up in a couple of weeks, where we're going to be using a lot of fun new things from them to do a beer that they wanted to do with Matt because of the award, and kind of play off of that. So I think there's still a lot of room there. I mean, the stuff that the hop companies are doing is really amazing. You know, one of the new products that we're using in this new beer is called Cryopop, which Yakima Chief does, which is it's a thiol-rich blend of cryo lupulin powder, essentially. So, you know, they've gotten to the point where they can analyze these hops at the level where they're picking out different thiols that are going to express these really nice, you know, kind of tropical wine-like aromas in beer. And they're saying, you know, we don't have to do this on a varietal level anymore. We can just analyze different lots of hops from a harvest, pinpoint the thiols we want for this flavor profile we're going for. And then, you know, we can use the cryo process that, you know, cryo is super popular in the industry now, you know, just because you get a more concentrated hop flavor from it. And they can use the process to concentrate just the flavors they want and blend it. And then, you know, it's targeted for use during fermentation with different yeasts. You know, they're good at doing the biotransformation. So I think there's a lot of exciting stuff going on there, you know, pivoting obviously away from the seltzer side, which, you know, is its own frontier. So there's that. And then so yeast, you know, it's this is something that I, you know, it's new technology in the last few years, but genetically engineering yeast. And so like using CRISPR technology to do gene insertion and say, hey, I want this one gene from this one yeast or a wild yeast here that, you know, might not make good beer on its own, but it has this one gene expression that does this thing that I like. Well, you can insert that into a brewing yeast that has proven performance and now get a brewing yeast that you already know you like the flavor profile to do something extra, like even more. So Omega Yeast is doing a really good job at that. And also Berkeley, Berkeley Yeast Lab. We use any of their stuff yet, but I did a collaboration beer with another brewery where we used one of their strains. That was really interesting. So we're gonna start playing around with some more stuff there as far as you know, these biotransformation engineered yeasts. You know, and then Omega's already done some interesting stuff with just hybridizing yeasts, not even doing the more technical genetic engineering stuff. But, you know, we won a medal at JBF a couple years ago with a Saison brewed with one of their proprietary yeasts that's a hybrid of two different strains that they were able to make. That so instead of getting a blend yeast, you get a single pure strain yeast that's actually a hybrid flavor profile, picking, you know, the best qualities of two different yeasts that you really like and saying, well, this yeast does this well and this yeast does this well, so why can't we make the best of both worlds? So seeing what these guys are doing, I mean, some of the smartest people, you know, that have, you know, PhDs in biology that are working on this stuff, they're enhancing what we can do and giving us tools as brewers to really expand frontiers. So I think both the yeast realm and what's going on with hop products, both present really cool frontiers that, you know, they're not necessarily going to make completely novel flavor profiles. You know, it's not going to make beer that tastes like something completely unlike beer, but it's going to allow brewers to make beers that have really great expressive profiles and just make better beer, better IPAs, you know, especially. You know, we're always chasing a bigger, more stable hop aroma. You know, if I can, you know, put an IPA in a can that is going to taste even better 2 months down the road, you know, versus falling off a month now, I'd love to do that, you know, as long as I'm not using any, you know, black magic, any, you know, some weird, you know, chemical product that people wouldn't like or something like that. But, you know, if I have yeast strains and hop products that are going to allow us to really just optimize the natural compounds created during the brewing process, then, you know, that's a win for everybody.
Yeah. I dropped out of organic chemistry like a month in, but, that's a lot more interesting than seltzers that look like, you know, the colors of Otter Pops. And I didn't know there was, you know, like hybrid yeast being genetically modified. And I mean, leave it to science to, you know, take it to the next place, I guess. And it made me start thinking about like Jurassic Park of like beer or something. But
I hope they're cautious about it. You know, as far as I know, at least with Omega, there's a new strain from them that we're going to trial pretty soon, where it's, you know, the London 3 kind of type yeast that is really popular with hazy IPAs. They've engineered a new strain based on that. It has almost the same flavor profile, but it has a gene that cleaves thiols at a much higher rate during fermentation. So, you're going to get much higher levels in beer than you would otherwise. So some of the great flavors, a lot of that kind of like passion fruit and white wine and stuff like that, you're going to get a higher level in an IPA than you would otherwise using this strain. And London 3 was already a great strain for that. It already has some biotransformation positive qualities to it. And that's why it is so popular for hazy IPAs, because it really does that. And, it also produces, a high level of esters that are complementary to hops. So I'm really excited to see where that goes. And yeah, you just never know. It's like as soon as you feel like everything's been done, someone out there is going to push the envelope and do something that you never thought of. And that's the beauty of having an industry that's so varied and has, so many good brewers in it. Because there's always something somebody's thinking of that you never thought of. And I think, a brewery like us, we try to push things, as we can, but, for the most part, we're a big ship. And we have to focus on core brands and just kind of like, dialing in. We might not be always the first person to push a new trend, but I think our kind of core mission is always, can we be the best one, at the scale for, something you can go to, the grocery store any old time and buy a six pack of, can get you like the best version of that and be your go-to.
Yeah.
And that's where we're at. Yeah, I don't know. We just don't want to leave anything behind, basically. I think we have so much fun doing all these new projects, and we have such a great brewing team that comes up with great ideas and is always constantly just hopefully working on making better beer. So, I think the next 25, who knows? I don't know if I'm around for that anniversary. I don't know how old I'd be at that point. I'd be almost a retirement age at that point. So we shall see. But yeah. Hopefully Firestone's still kicking and, still making great beer.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the time. I'll let you go back to I don't know if you got diapers to change, but
I'm sure I do.
yeah. All right. Well, Sam, thank you for the time. And yeah, I'll look forward to what's next from you guys. Thank you, Sam, running the show at the Propagator in Venice, California, for Firestone Walker. If you have not been there before, I do recommend checking it out if you're in LA or when you're in LA. You can find all the classics, Pivo, DBA, Union Jack, but also a lot of interesting barrel-aged stuff, sour stuff from Barrel Works, a lot of very interesting stuff that you may have never heard of, and small batch stuff, one-of-a-kind stuff. Test it out, see how it goes. I mentioned like the Kolsch Fermented IPA, Kvike Imperial Stout. Some very interesting things going on there that, whether or not they work out in the long run, kind of determined by how things go there, but some very unique things to try out there. And word has it that maybe even a cold IPA in the near future. So that's becoming a thing. I think that's that for this episode. Hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to follow on social, subscribe on your podcast platform. I know everyone enjoys hearing this at the end of every single episode, almost as much as I enjoy repeating it at the end of every single episode. So, thank you for listening. Next week, another episode. Come back for that next Thursday. And until then, sláinte.
Hold on, sorry, you're going to have to edit this. That's obviously, I just have a spinning wheel of death in my screen.